discretion is advised.
Good evening, everybody. It's 11 o'clock and welcome. It's Wednesday, May 27th, 2020, and thanks for joining us for the 87th episode of the Rock and Roll Shrink Radio Show here on Blog Talk Radio. Special thanks to our host, NDB Media. I'm Casey Shapiro, and with me tonight is Dr. Stephen Mathis, a.k.a. the Rock and Roll Shrink. We will be taking calls from our listeners all evening during the show at 914-338-0314. You can also follow along in our live chat room on blogtalkradio.com as the show is happening. Before we begin, a couple quick disclaimers. The show does not constitute a doctor-client relationship, nor legal or medical representation of any kind. Also, the views expressed on this show are those of Dr. Mathis and Ms. Shapiro, and are not an official stance on behalf of the psychological community or its peer vetting or regulatory bodies. And now, a topic-relevant bit of music played by Dr. Mathis himself. Take it away, Doc. As always, thank you for that, and if you would, please let us know the name of the song and the artist and its relevance to tonight's topic.
Well, since we're going to be discussing reaching out for help, I thought the Beatles song Help would be a great intro song. So, yeah, go figure. Talk about concrete reasoning. So there you go. That was my rationale, and I'm sticking to it.
Yeah, thank you, Lily Tomlin. Yes, and actually, I did flagrantly borrow from that for tonight's topic. As Dr. Mathis mentioned, tonight's episode is entitled Help-No-One-Listens, which we will discuss in a moment. Before we begin our topic discussion, though, let's first go to the Rock and Roll Shrink Recalls, a moment of rock music trivia stories as recounted by Dr. Mathis, if you would, sir.
Okay, so tonight's little trivia piece is on someone that probably very few of our listeners have ever heard of, but this person's influence has reached very wide and far and has influenced a number of major artists in our common folk, including Kate Bush, Pink Floyd, Robert Plant, Ian Anderson of Jethro Tull, Jimmy Page, he's a buddy of Jimmy Page's, and Pete Townsend. And the person about whom I am speaking is a gentleman named Roy Harper, who is an English folk rock singer. He's a singer, songwriter, guitarist. And he has roughly, and I lost count, it's like 30-something records out there that span like a 50-year career. I mean, it's like... he's like one of the most prolific guys that hardly anybody's ever heard of. There's a song off Led Zeppelin 3 called Hats Off to Roy Harper, which is Jimmy Page's kind of nod to him in doing kind of this thing. And he and Page actually did a record together back in the 80s. It's really pretty good. It's one of those kind of deep cut things that most people don't really know about. But it's if you ever can get a copy of that thing, it's really, 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 really good. So, you know, he's British, of course, because all, you know, the great rock guys are British, right? Anyway, he was born in the suburb of Manchester, I think, and had influences from his mom and dad. And unfortunately, his mom passed away very shortly after his birth, so he had to live with his mom, his father and stepmother. I'll get it right in a minute. And he got very turned off. She was evidently uber religious, and he kind of like, kind of got turned off. But he got into music very, very early, educated at King Edward School, and eventually joined the Royal Air Force, I think 15 maybe, and originally was scheduled to be a pilot. But he got pretty unhappy with the discipline of the military and basically got a discharge and kind of had like, I don't want to say a breakdown, but had kind of his moment in the mental health arena, and ended up basically tried to act like he was crazy so he could get out of the discharge. And he ended up, for a short time, getting ECT, electroconvulsive therapy, shock therapy. That's for sure if that helped his music genes or not. But at any rate, he was influenced a lot by American blues artists and folk singers. So people like Woody Guthrie, Big Bill Boonsey, Lead Belly, all those folks were big influences. Miles Davis, actually, the jazz musician, was a big influence for him. So he started playing this kind of lyrical, kind of folky blues music. He was also very much influenced by a lot of the Beat Generation poets, as well as a lot of the Romantic poets like Keats and Shelley and Byron and those kind of folks. The Beat poets he was influenced with particularly was Jack Kerouac. So he started, when he started performing originally, he was reciting poetry. And kind of playing music in the background, and that sort of evolved into more of a musical career and less of a recitation thing. So he got signed and did his first record, which was called Sophisticated Beggar, which I think was in the mid-60s, 65, 66, and has gone on to really do a bunch of, as I've said, probably... I don't know, 50-something recordings, including something, a boatload of live records that he's made. I've actually never heard any of his live records. I just was researching some of his history and saw that in there. But, you know, he's started out doing more traditional folk, but has sort of branched into more folky, what I would call esoteric folk, folk rock, that sort of kind of thing. So he's been doing this thing for a long time, influenced by a number of people. And as he's been playing out, a lot of people became aware of him, the famous people like folks like Johnny Marr, for example, an American person. And he was in an alternative rock band, The Smiths, more recently. But, you know, obviously Page and Plant were very much influenced by him, and as I see him becoming a buddy of Jimmy Page's. And so they've done a lot of work together, and, you know, he's done work with all kinds of artists, mostly in Scotland and England, in the UK, Scotland, England, that sort of thing. He's played a lot of the big theaters, like the Rainbow Theater, which Page and Plant have done, and the Firm has played there, and just a shootload of people have done that. and all the other thing that he's really famous for that most people don't know. So on the 75 Pink Floyd record, Wish You Were Here, probably one of the big hits off that is Have a Cigar. And most people don't know that is not Pink Floyd singing it. That's Roy Harper. So there's nobody in Pink Floyd that's singing that song. That's like a one-off for them. So the Roger Waters initially was scheduled to sing it, and Roy Harper was in the neighborhood, and he's like, oh, let me have a go at it. And he's like, oh, my gosh. So he's actually the vocals on Have a Cigar, which is one of the very few Pink Floyd songs that they didn't actually sing. So, yeah.
Wow.
He's done.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. So that's kind of like people know him, but they don't know him. You know, they're like, oh, wait a minute. No.
And they don't know
Roy
they know
Harper.
Him.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, and I mean, he's done work where backing vocals were Paul and Linda McCartney on some of his records. So, I mean, he's extremely well respected. And he's, you know, Robert Plant's done vocals with him before. So, I mean, this guy's had a very, 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 very long career. He's recorded for a bunch of different labels, including Chrysalis, which is what Toll was on for a while. And he's done work with Kate Bush. I mean, he's all over the place, you know, and he's toured with people in his own band, including Tony Franklin, you know, who was the bass player for the Firm. He's played for and recorded with a shoot ton of people. He and Jimmy Page did a tour back in the early 80s. And out of that is what happened. They got some of their, did a couple of their studio recordings. You know, they've done work with, he's done work at the Hammersmith Odeon, which is a very famous venue in Britain. It was actually one of the places I visited when I went there, just so I could go there and say, hey, I've been here. He's also gotten... Yeah, I mean, well, I also went to the Royal Albert Hall, cause, you know, and I also went, of course, to Abbey Road, so I could go, hey, you know. But he, you know, he's just been all over the place, recorded, you know, semi-classical stuff. He established one of his own record labels in the early 90s called Science Friction, which I thought was just a hoot. Oh, yeah, isn't that great? And he's contributed to Toll songs with Ian Anderson and just done a bunch of stuff with him, with just a ton of people, as I mentioned, Pete Townsend earlier. He's done almost and he's still recording. He's still out there playing. And I think in 2000 or 2001, he did almost an entirely acoustic album with very little else on it called The Green Man. And, you know, he's on doing tours at the Royal Festival Hall, and you know, he's just played with all sorts of, you know, John Redbourn and all sorts of folks. He also has a son who has followed in his footsteps, who is also a folk singer, kind of folky, folk rocky, kind of whatever stuff. So, you know, the man is just has been all over the place. He's still recording, still doing his thing. Yeah, I think his son's name is Nick Harper, and he, as I said, he's out. He occasionally tours with his dad, and then tours on his own. So, no, not here. Sorry, guys, that's my other phone. So, that is not Roy Harper calling. Yeah, that wasn't Roy Harper calling to cuss me out.
You know, if it was, I'd have let him.
Bloody hell, you got it wrong. Yeah. Anyway, so I wanted to put a shout out to him because he is a largely unrecognized guy who has just been ridiculously profundus in his recording career and with folks he knows and played and sung and recorded with. And, you know, it's just, I thought it was really funny and ironic that people have heard, the Pink Floyd song a whole lot of time and had no clue he was the vocalist on it. So I really wanted to mention that to get everybody going. Maybe I need to listen to this guy more. So there you have it.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, so now I need to go back and listen to it. I'm like, who did I think that was?
Yeah, I know. Well, it was originally scheduled for Roger Waters to sing it. Yeah. Roger Waters was initially set up to sing it, but he couldn't hit the notes.
Whoops. Okay.
So there you go.
That's fair.
Yeah.
Good to know.
There you go.
All right. Good. Thank you for that. Very cool. Just out of curiosity, what is his connection to Kate Bush? Do you know? Because I know Kate was very heavily mentored by a couple of guys in Pink Floyd.
Right, and I think that's how I think that's how he originally met her. But he's done work with her. She's sung on his records before. I mean, done background vocals. I mean, he's been all over the place.
Fascinating. Very cool.
Yeah.
Good. That's definitely something I want to go check out later. You know, I love these little did you know sort of things. So awesome. Great. Again, guys, we will take calls from our listeners and questions in the online chat room throughout the evening until about midnight. So feel free to give us a call or hit me up in the chat room. Again, the number is 914-338-0314. And speaking of Pink Floyd, I have a little clip that I was keeping around for another show that I did, so I'm just going to throw that in here real quick. Thought I'd have a little fun with that. All right. So, welcome to Help, No One Listens. Tonight's show title borrows from the Beatles song Help and a lesser known but recent Ray Davies of the Kinks 2007 song called No One Listens. We may also draw thematically a tiny bit from Tommy by The Who and The Wall by Pink Floyd, both rock operas about people in distress who were not being heard or responded to effectively. In the last several weeks, and actually going back to a year ago, excuse me, we've had several topics about different aspects of coping, crises, loss, emergencies, and similar concepts. We've had many episodes on depression and suicide. More recently, we specifically had episode 68, a year ago, Wish You Were Here, which was on grief, loss, mourning, and closure. That was on May 1st, 2019. Very recently, episode 83, 2 Minutes to Midnight, Terror Management Theory, on January 8th, and episode 86 in two parts, Flirting with Disaster, Coping Under Crisis, part one on April 1st and part two on April 15th. And then we took a month hiatus from the show because I had a medical emergency in my immediate family, and then more recently, earlier this month, it ended in a death. And as we often do, I draw from my experiences personally or out in the news and social media for topics. And so here we are. Tonight, we wanted to focus specifically on the psychological aspects of helping, both from the giving and receiving ends. We've spoken before about grief, fear, and loss. We haven't focused much on the mechanic of responding to these in others or even in ourselves. We don't focus on it as a culture or a society or try to teach it in schools or civic groups, and yet nearly all of us will be on both the giving and receiving ends of help in a crisis, moment of need, or in grieving at some point in our lives. So tonight we will discuss first the community function of helping, not doing things alone. Two, helpfulness in different forms, you know, from friends, family, neighbors, community, etc. Three, when helpfulness isn't helpful and why or why not. And last, number four, suggestions for both givers and receivers to improve healthy helping. And before we get started on this, I want to check in with you, Dr. Mathis, and see if there are any points that you want to bring up before we get going here.
Nope, I'm ready to boogie.
All right. Okay, so number one, the community function of helping, not doing it alone. So in general, modern, current, Western, and especially American society values the individual in ways that encourage living alone as adults, more so than some other cultures that may emphasize more common, multi-generational, or at least multiple adult households as the typical norm. One thing we've learned about ourselves over the last few decades, where such a thing has become economically and socially feasible, is that individuals are well suited to the demands of this arrangement to a wide variety of degrees. The basic chores and rigors of maintaining even a rudimentary household or home of any sort can be a certain level of time consuming and require certain organizational and practical skills and resources that not everyone has or not enough of a degree. This, in turn, points out that most people will at some point need or at least want or prefer to combine some or many aspects of their living responsibilities with others, depending on the other demands of their time from family, friends, work, hobbies, etc. Even when things are going well, it's a lot to manage day-to-day life, and combining efforts or lending help when you're already doing a task nearby. Often use cooperation and social and literal bartering to ease the burden of tasks on one another. We cannot all be good at all the tasks or have enough time, money, resources, and skills to repair, create, and maintain everything. It behooves us all to participate in the mutuality of helping one another. Some people only need or want an occasional favor. Some people are somewhat, quote, helpless about household things for a variety of reasons and need more help. Life events happen, such as illness or changes in circumstances, and even the best of rigorous planners can be caught unprepared. Some persons in our society excessively romanticize the notion of never needing assistance or even companionship, and frequently those who brag on this as making them superior to others have simply merely had good luck for the moment, often eating their proverbial words eventually. There's no shame in being independent and capable, but to disregard the practicality of sharing and dividing labor and ideas in an agreeable and pragmatic manner is not a sign of maturity or strength. There are some situations in which individuals take advantage of the concept of help, mutuality, or charity, and we will discuss those later. But for our core premise, we assert that even the most prepared and capable independent humans may want or need help from time to time, and that disarrangement is healthy and normal because we are not built to truly exist in a complete vacuum, even as loners. And with this, I will pause and turn to Dr. Mathis and see if you have any additional comments.
Nope, I'm good, thanks.
Alrighty, I'm a little surprised, actually, considering that you have lived on your own, although you do have help.
Yes, and there are certain things I absolutely do need help with. and we were joking about this before the show. My electrical mechanical reasoning skills are less than zero. And fortunately, I have people whose brain works fine in that arena because mine does not. And I have no problem asking for help whatsoever. I think anybody who is too proud or ashamed to ask for help is robbing themselves from a really meaningful kind of thing, because people who care about you or have some sort of connection to you, it really empowers the relationship by you asking to help. It really makes the relationship much more flow, much more evenly and much more mutual. And, it strengthens the relationship. It doesn't show weakness in any way, shape, or form.
Yes. And that is actually a very good way to summarize some of the key points that we hope you guys take away from this tonight. So, that is good to add that in there. And we're going to talk about this several times. So I'm really hoping you guys absorb this tonight. So part two, helpfulness in different forms. Now that we've established that helping one another is generally healthy and appropriate, let's talk a bit about what helping is. Some of you may be wondering what we even mean, that everybody knows what helping already means. However, being helpful is a matter of personal preference and taste, and involves a bit of intervention in someone else's life. And it is not all that rare that people are not raised with an understanding of helping others at a basic level or how to navigate such a personal arrangement. Quote, being helpful, regardless of however well-intentioned, can sometimes end up being awkward at best, wasteful, or even create further burdens for the receiver if the help is not handled in particular ways. Unfortunately, there are few opportunities in our society today for people to learn how to navigate being helpful. It isn't discussed that often at home. It isn't brought up in schools, except maybe just a touch in early classes where rudimentary manners and etiquette customs are first taught to young children. But then things tend to end there. Some people who get involved with certain types of civic duty or social groups, such as scouting, youth groups, church groups, charitable organizations, and similar entities are some of the only people who independently are encouraged to acts of service and helping towards others by anyone in our society. there are some individuals who, by their upbringing or by their natural inclinations as they grow up, tend to have a service nature or a natural helpfulness. We all have a couple of those friends who are always the ones who get people together when a friend, neighbor, or relative has a need. Not everyone has that trait or the gift for it, though, and so there's layers to being helpful, where there's those who excel at it often end up having to rally the troops towards a goal, big or small. Some people want to be helpful but never know how to begin, so they're always the ones quietly waiting for the organizer types to declare a project and instructions. People contribute each to their abilities. Some give time. Some give money or supplies. Some network people, information, or coordinate resources. Some are not good at this, but they want to be led. The point is that being helpful is a skill as well, as contributing, making help happen is also a gift as well as the actual gift given. So once again, let's talk about what helpfulness is. It is being intimate with another person's life and needs to where you identify something they lack that perhaps you can provide or make happen for them. Sounds simple, right? Sometimes it is. Sometimes the help is a tiny thing, or it can just be super easy for you, just not for the other person. Not talking about anybody in the computer skills at all here. The measure of the help is its value to the receiver, not how much pomp and circumstance went into its creation. A tiny thing is huge to the person who just cannot do it for themselves. Helpfulness does not have to be a grand, showy thing that other people even know about. It can be in secret or even anonymously. Sometimes help is one time, such as fixing one item. Sometimes a person can need help with a thing on an ongoing basis, such as a sick person needing their lawn mowed. Help can be easy for you on your way to your own errands and be valid. It can be a huge project involving many people, even a neighborhood or a fundraiser. You know, you all see those GoFundMes for people. All help can be helpful if it is truly of help to the receiver. And this sounds simple and obvious, but you would be surprised how many people trip up on this, which is why we are kind of reinventing the wheel and explaining things that might seem obvious. We just really want to be sure you guys are clear. This points out the other key thing, that's the other key component to helping. As we mentioned above, one must be intimate enough with the receiver's life to correctly and accurately know about a need for help. It isn't truly helpful to people if you just do random things that they guess could be helpful, but don't contribute any actual value to the recipient. So that first step of accurately identifying what is needed or wanted is imperative to the success of any attempt at helpfulness. Many people tend to sit around during an emergency and say, well, I wanted to help so-and-so out, but I had no idea what to do. Or else they just do random crap they heard about with no regard for actual needs or wishes or capacity to accept that kind of help. This is why you have three components to helping: the identifier of the need, the coordinator of the resources, and the actual resources. And these may or may not all be one person, or it could be up to dozens of people. The most important thing each and every person should learn to always do when in a situation where someone in the circle needs help is to always begin with this question before any other. Do you just need to talk about your situation and problem, or would you like help with it? And if, and only if, they say yes to help, then how would you like me to help out here? Listen to them very carefully. Repeat it back to them and make sure you heard it. And then no matter what you think is good for them, consider that a promise to them and honor it. If you absolutely must renegotiate the help they asked for, do them the courtesy of choosing what changes. Do not exclude them from a voice in their own aid. This is all about helping them and nothing else. That is what is helpfulness. And at this point, I'm going to check in with Dr. Mathis and see what he would like to add.
Yeah, I think it's really important to ask a person what sort of help they want, or, you know, what can I do that'll be helpful? That's another way to say that, so that the person can, you know, say what he or she needs and not you just guessing what you think he or she needs, or offer a help that they may not need. And it's that's a really important point that you made about that.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm going to gesture at that quite a bit tonight, because we as a society, as a culture, don't normalize that question. I have created for myself the habit of doing that, and it was awkward and hard to turn into a habit, and it still feels forced to say, but it doesn't matter if it's forced. I don't care anymore. You know, I've had to learn to tell myself to let that go, because what I need to do is create an environment for that person to let me know what they want. And the best way to do that is to ask them exactly that. You know, how can I help you? What would you like help with?
Right.
We need to normalize that question. That question needs to be normal and comfortable. And it kind of isn't right now. So one of the takeaways of tonight is I want that to become that way. I want to start that journey and encourage people to start learning that
especially
habit.
Well, especially given what's going on right now with the, as I like to call it, my corona situation.
Yeah.
And speaking of helping, I just remembered. And speaking of helping, I just remembered the name of the Roy Harper Jimmy Page album is called Jagula.
Oh, ha! Okay.
I just came back. Well, of course, it just came into my mind because I wasn't thinking about it, right?
Yeah. You stopped trying. There was
great record. Yeah, great record.
I'll have to check that out later. Okay. Cool. Excellent. All right, so let's get to part three. When helpfulness isn't helpful, and why or why not? Now that we know certain core concepts about being helpful, this should make it much easier to understand why sometimes when we do things for others in need that we think should be helpful, it doesn't always give us the results we may have expected. So, in no particular order, here are some misunderstandings about helpful gestures that people really need to unlearn, break the habit of doing these by default. Point number one, helping is not about you. Your preferences have no relevance. They are not help if they do not create value for the recipient. Listen to the recipient and honor that unless you are certain it will result in harm. Then go to them or their coordinator and renegotiate the promised help. Number two, cliches are not always helpful to everyone and not always welcome. They may even create further burdens or guilt for the recipient, who might want to show gratitude for the intention and not hurt your feelings, but may have no use for the gesture given. I have an example of that that I didn't put in the script. A couple of years ago, we had needed some help keeping up with our house, and somebody had really, really vehemently pushed mowing our lawn, except that we've had a lawn guy since we bought this house in 2012. And so our lawn didn't need help, and they made a big deal about bringing the lawnmower over and all that, blah, blah, blah. They didn't ask. They kind of just steamrolled this over us, and we didn't want to be unkind, and we knew they were trying to be helpful, but it got really out of control, and it got awkward trying to clean that up and get them to stop and let it go. And so this is an example of what I'm talking about. They wanted to help, but they were very attached to what that looked like and started doing stuff. And it made it difficult for us because we didn't want to be ungrateful. There's a lot of people who have problems that nobody offers to help. So we didn't want to be that guy, you know? So anyway, that's an example of what I'm talking about. Don't automatically start buying specific things or inviting yourself to make food without asking or bringing things to the house unannounced or doing tasks. Don't parent other people by by cutting them out of the process of their own help. The next thing is shaming. Don't make needing help a contest, especially either where never needing help, or more like never asking for it, even when you need it, is a virtue, as well as not making it a contest to see who can do the most for someone. Don't make the recipient feel beholden to you. It's not a bribe or a hook in them. Give help with no strings, no judgment, or just keep that help to yourself. That kind of help is a weapon, not a help. And related, keeping score. Related to the above, don't keep a scorecard about helping someone. There is one exception. The one exception is if you fear someone is what I refer to as professionally falling apart because they know someone always will save them. It could be time for intervention at that point, and that's kind of a whole separate discussion. I am acquainted with a couple of people that I feel engage in a lot of professional falling apart because most of their adult life that I have known them, someone always rescues them and they make some ridiculous choices. And in those cases, it's not about keeping score, but it is kind of about, you know, I've helped you a bazillion times and you keep making really crappy choices and pooping up your life. And that needs to stop at some point. But again, don't confuse that with the keeping score of like, well, I've come and helped you at your house 7 times, so you need to do this for me now, or I'm never helping again, even though that person might really be in need for, you know, medical reasons or monetary reasons or whatever. Just in general, if you're going to hold how much you help over someone, over someone's head, it isn't help, it's a leash. So stop it. And keeping score number 2. However, sometimes there are situations where people gladly take help all the time. But when the givers may need something, even if it's small, they have a reasonable expectation that maybe at least someone of those they helped would be part of any helping in return. And it can become very sour between people when all the helping efforts are one-sided. And I know that sometimes if you're somebody who needs help, you may not necessarily get back on your feet to where you can turn around and flip it very quickly. That often happens, especially if there's a big emergency. But, you know, basically overall, the whole process needs to stop being a way of one-upsmanship or comparing or a contest or things to hold over people. That whole entire business, knock all of those iterations off. Next thing I want to talk about is empty offers. This is a huge cliche. Get out of the habit of not showing up when you tell people, quote, if you need anything, call me. I am not going to tell any of you to stop offering that, although it would solve the problem. People would be well served and of better character to become the sort who would freely offer this and mean it. But don't solve it by never offering. Solve it by stretching yourself, inconveniencing yourself, showing the recipient that they matter and you really do have their back by doing the bothersome help. It may mean a late night phone call or a car ride to get picked up or listening to a crying rant or letting them crash at your place or some other inconveniences. So what? Doesn't it feel nice and safe when you are despondent and someone does this for you? Give that to them. You'll be fine, and the world will be a better place for you having offered. Let go of the helper cookies. People have this thing, they want the feel-good credit without doing the work. Oh, I said, you know, if you need anything, call me. And then they get called, and they dust, they ghost, they disappear. People always remember who showed up and who stood them up. There are no helper cookies. You don't actually get the credit of the person who showed up at 3 a.m. and came and got someone. So stop saying that if you're not going to be good for it, and don't solve it by stopping saying it at all. Solve it by being there. Next point, helping is not your therapy time. Some people do things in the name of helping that are weird and awkward and clearly are about resolving something unrelated to the now, that is within themselves and about someone else. And this is an offshoot of offering help that wasn't asked for. It's a specific kind of help that gets really kind of awkward. If you messed up before or you weren't there for someone, don't use now to make therapy for yourself. People can tell when you're not being about their needs. Related item, when talking to people in crisis, don't tell them where they are in life. Don't tell them how they are, what timeline they're on, or what they need. It is not helpful to have someone push their ideas of your life on you, and on top of it all, they're just wrong. This creates emotional labor for the recipient, and you make things weird and awkward now. For example, your timeline for grieving or moving on or what you should or shouldn't have done by now. Don't do those things, because those things are about fixing something going on with you, and leave that recipient alone. They are not your therapist. Next point, no toxic positivity. We haven't really talked about that before, but I'm sure you guys have heard it out in social media. Don't police someone's feelings. They need a safe place to let them out and work them through. If you cannot provide that, don't scold them for needing it. Don't tell them to get over it. Don't tell them, be positive, everybody has problems, or similar garbage. Let them be where they are. That is what toxic positivity is. People are allowed to have a shitty day and they're
happy
to tell you. Yeah, well, you know, it's a cute T-shirt. Love Bobby McFerrin and Mayor Baba and all these things, but stop it. When people are in an emergency,
yeah,
they don't need to hear that. That's not positivity.
Yeah.
That is policing their feelings. Cut it out. Next one, lack of coping skills. And this can be for the helper or the receiver. Some people who want to help may never have been taught a healthy example of how to effectively and authentically be in service to others in need or pain. Or they may have their own mental health issues and may not know how to respond properly. However, they most likely can follow basic directions. And so if anyone is concerned that this could mean yourself, our suggestions above and that are coming in section 4 are straightforward and easy to follow for just about everyone and should result in a healthier helping response for both giver and receiver. Just understand that some people are much better at, quote, the helping thing than others. Next point about receivers. People receiving help are often overwhelmed and may not have been self-aware people before the emergency. They drown in demand to know what they need and reports on how they are. They may have no damn idea. This is all the more reason to have a coordinator to intervene, something we're going to talk about in section 4. Receivers may also have pathological problems coping, self-esteem or executive dysfunction issues that make it so hard to even know things, such as what one needs in an emergency. You know, that requires a level of self-awareness a lot of people don't have, bottom line. And last thing I'm going to poke at is checking in. Use a sense of balance and restraint on checking in. Stop and think about how many other people may also be asking someone the exact same cliched questions. How are you holding up? Do you need anything? And I'm not trying to be an asshole. I know people mean well when they do this, but I'm calling attention to that they don't think it through. The best rule of thumb here is, if you were not already someone who checks in with that person on a daily or even just a few times a week basis before the crisis, don't try to become one now. Stop it. It's highly likely you're reinventing the wheel and overwhelming them with the same stuff 20 times. The people who were already interacting that often will still be doing so. If they had no one like this, double check on that. They might, and maybe you just didn't know. Let's instead normalize the idea of the people closer to them being the coordinators of efforts, kind of like a maid of honor type function. Let someone outside the crisis arbitrate how much attention to send. They're in a better position to know what's welcome and needed, and also to know when it's not being duplicated. And here I'm going to pause and check in with you, Dr. Mathis.
I'm good, actually. Thank you.
Alrighty, section four. Short and sweet, but very, very important suggestion for both givers and receivers to improve healthy helping. Aside from what we've already said about, you know, listening to what people tell you, and I'm going to get to that again in this section at the end. But the number one thing that I want you guys to take away from this, I want to standardize this, make this become a thing somehow. The maid of honor type coordinator, and apologies for the gendered structure of the suggestion. I wanted to convey a role that doesn't really exist much in our society yet, except maybe by providence or by accident. In cases of small, one-time, fleeting acts of helping out, it's probably less important. But in greater moments of crisis, one of the biggest suggestions we can make is somehow to normalize the role of someone to become functionally like a maid of honor is to a bride, but for the recipient of help. It doesn't have to be a woman. Doesn't have to be any particular gender, but that function of that person who is close to them, who's going to coordinate all the stuff. They coordinate the queries, delegate the tasks, and they're close to the recipient, so they will have an accurate sense of needs and boundaries and the schedule and what needs to happen. A best friend is ideal, or a relative, someone who knows them well and is willing to do the heavy social lifting. And most of all, as we said several times tonight, ask, and listen to and honor what you are told. And with this, checking in with you again, Dr. Mathis, for commentary.
Yeah, I think you did a good job. That you covered most of the main aspects that I think are important for listeners to hear.
All right, excellent. So in summary, we hope now that our listeners know about and understand better how to give and receive help in a healthy and constructive manner, whether it's a small trifle in passing or a huge rallying around someone in crisis. We know you guys mean well. Everybody has a big heart, and they want to be helpful, but sometimes they kind of just react. You hear stuff in social media. You see it on TV and in the movies, and you think that's what you're supposed to do, and you've never really learned any better. Or, you know, sometimes some of us do pick up things in TV and the movies that's helpful. You know, for example, I was raised in the great Steel Magnolias tradition, the movie. And basically when this grand crisis, all the women descend on the house, and you do three things immediately. You clean out the fridge, you clean out the freezer, and you clean up the bathroom. Because what's going to happen is sometime later that weekend, everyone's going to come to the house with a casserole. So the person in distress needs a place to go have a bubble bath and a glass of wine and get the hell out of the way. So you clean out all that fridge and that freezer because people are going to come and bring food, and you organize it for that person, and then you give them a place to go hide that's nice and clean and relaxing. And you do that for people, and it's tacitly understood. You know, that's kind of a running joke, but I've done that several times for people that have had deaths in the family or an accident or an illness or, you know, whatever. But not everybody grows up with that, and there are different parts of the country where the culture is a little different, and that would be considered invasive. So I'm very sensitive to the fact that I don't do that to people that are not from the culture I grew up in, shall we say, you know, because I understand that some people find that a little weird. But, you know, the point is we're acknowledging that there's a part of most of us that wants to help. But like many things, we grow up and there's a need for helping, but we're not taught how to do it. So we kind of bumble our way through, and sometimes we step on stuff, and sometimes we make bad blood and we don't mean it. Sometimes people ask us, well, what do I do? And we don't know. And then everybody gets flustered. So hopefully tonight we have made some suggestions on both ends of this problem that can help you guys out a little bit. It may not be easy at first. It may be weird. It may be a little awkward because we're not in these habits. But what it is simple. And if you do it and put some faith in the process, It is effective. And both of those things will help you. So with that, this concludes our show, Help No One Listens. And I'm going to check in one last time, Dr. Mathis, and see if there is anything overall about this that you would like to add before we wrap up tonight.
Yeah, I just think the big take home is, you know, ask what kind of help a person needs and listen to them. And if you can do it, do what they need you to do. Don't come in with your own agenda.
Yes, I absolutely agree. It's tempting. And honestly, people may not realize that's what they were doing. And mm-hmm. So hopefully when we gesture at it, maybe they can stop and think, you know, well, I know I wanted to do this and I wanted to do that. You know, it's one of the big things that happens a lot lately, I've noticed, especially, you know, with the quarantine going on and a lot of people being in distress, is cooking culture. Everybody wants to have food delivered or send 30 casseroles or all this other stuff. And that's great, but sometimes it doesn't always work. For example, in our area, there's almost no restaurants that deliver because we're way out in the country. We barely have a few that do takeout. We do have a few. But, you know, we don't have Uber Eats or any of that stuff. We actually don't even have Instacart. They list us on the app, but when you try to order food, it says it's too far. You know, so they totally torture you and make you go through the process and then say, no, you can't have it. We just want to see if you would dance. But, you know, people do this thing, you know, they want to show up with casseroles. And many months ago, when we first started having, you know, medical issues here again, there were friends who were part of a community that we were connected to, showed up at the house with a very large meal that would have easily fed 10 people. We weren't prepared for it at all. We had no idea they were coming. I was in the middle of talking to my lawn guy, and they show up. And this, we were not prepared at all. We did not have room to store this food. We were not in a position to eat that much of it, and we wasted so much food. I actually cried because we had to throw so much out. We had no choice because we weren't prepared. And that's the whole, you know, clean the fridge and clean the freezer. You know, I didn't have my steel magnolias come and do my house because we had no idea this was coming. And so they meant well, but nobody asked if we needed this enormous meal. And so we had our tiny little two-person meal and then leftovers, and then the food was no good because we couldn't store it. So these are the kinds of things that we're hoping to help people understand about themselves and maybe cut down on the misunderstandings so that help can actually be helpful. And hopefully you guys will take that away tonight. So in conclusion, on behalf of myself, Dr. Mathis, and NDB Media, we want to thank our listeners this evening and give our appreciation to those of you who might be joining us later via podcast, iTunes, etc. So we'll see you guys in 2 weeks with a new discussion on Wednesday, June 10th at 11 p.m. Eastern Time right here on blogtalkradio.com. We'd also like to give a shout-out to some other NDB Media shows that are coming up over the next couple of weeks. Tomorrow night, Travel Itch Radio at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Now that camping season is here, the best way to preserve and cook food, as well as to provide light after dark, is to use solar-powered products. That's what Patrick Sherwin, CEO of Go Sun, will tell Dan Schlossberg and Keita Roberts. So listen live as Sherwin tells how he began in his garage, but now exports his products to more than 70 countries. Coming Saturday, Sports Talk with the Guys, Saturday Morning Extravaganza. I've read you this crazy lead story. It's the same one, same guys, 9 a.m. Eastern Time, this Saturday, the 30th. And the Walking Dead online viewing party is still on hiatus. Sunday, April 5th, was the temporary Season 10 finale due to a work stoppage related to the COVID-19 quarantine. Season 10, Episode 16, A Certain Doom, will air later in the summer, as well as the new third Walking Dead series, World Beyond. And we don't know what's going to happen to Fear yet. I will let you guys know. Coming on Monday Night in America with Roger Noriega, June 1st, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. Roger Noriega brings you his unique take on politics, current events, entertainment, sci-fi, and history. Please look for us on Facebook, on Twitter, on iTunes, and at www.rockandrollstrength.com. Good night, everybody. Thanks for joining us, and rock on.